Okay.
Yeah, I really would like you to talk more about May 1970.
Well, I think we had, on the campus, we really had gotten a strong anti-war sentiment going. I mean, I know that there were faculty who were very much, thinking along our lines, and we had a lot of demonstrations, and we felt like we were, making an impact. And no doubt the events at Kent State really congealed a lot of those thoughts, and particularly, as I was saying, the question of free speech rights. And I remember the chants of America with a K, thinking that we were going into some kind of, if not totalitarian, certainly authoritarian type government where people's rights were going to be trampled on. I think it also probably pushed a lot of people back away from their sort of counterculture ways. I think a lot of people, in fear, moved back into what would be considered more of a mainstream point of view. But certainly most of the people that I knew, that just made them more radicalized. I certainly didn't consider myself to be a, wild, rabid sort of radical, in the sense that, I wouldn't think of, burning down a building or destroying someone's property or something like that. But on the other hand, I felt that there were definitely, rights that we had as Americans that were starting to be lost. And I think a lot of students felt that way. And, a lot of the old line faculty probably felt the opposite. And I think there was a very strong contingent of very conservative faculty who felt that this was wrong, that students should not be involved in any kind of political activities, particularly not criticizing the government sort of thing. So
who would fall into that category in the faculty?
Oh, gee. I guess I'm thinking about some of the professors who I had, and maybe this is not fair, but Dr. Royston was one. I don't know if he's still living or not.
I don't know.
I have to go back. I could probably go back to some of my transcripts or something and look at courses that I was taking and tell you who the professors were, because I know that certainly after the strike there had been, I don't remember the exact details, but a lot of time had been missed from class, and I think exams had been missed and so on, and so there was an effort on the part of the administration to make sure that students who were involved in that were still able to complete that semester. And the professors who were unhappy with the way things worked out, that students were even going on strike, I think penalized a lot of us just on that basis, that you were involved in an activity which they didn't approve of. But in all fairness, we certainly had sort of gone off the edge academically at that point. We just let everything drop. That was certainly a very polarizing time. You definitely felt like there was a lot of tension in the air, and you had friends and you had enemies almost, and it was a rough time, I'd say. I mean, we kind of kept having our parties and sloughed it off somewhat, but I think it was left a pretty indelible impact on people.
Did you participate in the Free University classes that went on?
Somewhat, yeah. I'm trying to remember what we had going on then, but yeah, certainly I did. They were, you know, not academic in any sense, but boy, I hadn't even remembered that. Now that you mentioned it, I'd have to think back as to what all we did. Maybe we could take a break and
all. Okay, all right.
I guess you just sparked my memory a little bit as far as what was being put out, and although you said published, I don't know that I really thought of it in that way, but we had, back before the days of many Xerox machines and so on, we would manually type up these mimeograph sheets, and I think we had several things going out every day. We would mimeograph hundreds of copies, and we'd be out on campus handing out literature, trying to get people active, and I don't know if that's what you've got, is mimeograph stuff, and it's been saved. That's incredible. I'd love to see it.
It's quite a volume of stuff.
Boy, it's amazing that someone saved all of that. I don't think I did.
And the impression I got from reading this stuff is the townspeople were very involved, too. It wasn't just Washington and Lee. What's your memory of that?
Boy, I certainly remember that the townspeople and county people who I saw more of were, a lot of them were very, if not conservative, they were, very sort of anti-hippie, and of course this was the hippie time, if you will, and so there was a lot of negative feelings there. Now, I don't remember in town particularly how much was going on from an activist point of view. I mean, I remember there was a professor at VMI who was in the Democratic committee in town, and certainly from that point of view, the Democrats, the people who were against Nixon in general, had this as a focal point. And I guess if that's what you were thinking of, certainly there was a lot of that going on. I'd have to think back to remember all the names, but certainly the after 1972 and the impeachment attempts or attempt to impeach Nixon and so on, there was a lot of activity. Now, in my freshman year, I guess I didn't interact as much with the town people. I mean, I think there were certainly, younger townspeople who were, students or, young people out of high school working in jobs and so on, who, also felt the same way as far as the war was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have a real strong recollection of, who they were and, how they related. I know there was a lot of, there were faculty who were anti-war, and there were certainly students of faculty members who were, students of children, who either grown or, high school age, senior in high school age, who were pretty active. I'd say, Mario Pellicciaro was very active. Henry Sloss, he was probably the most activist and I think probably cost him his job, as I recall, of the professors or instructors. I'm not even sure what, you know, level he was on the hierarchy. Obviously wasn't tenured. Who were very supportive. I'm just trying to think back to all the things that we did put out on those mimeograph machines. It really brings back memories of typing all this stuff on those blue mimeos, and you know, what a different age it was. But we certainly put out a lot of stuff. And we did a lot of organizing to get people to go to Washington. We did a number of trips to join the marches on Washington. And I think Jeff Jingold, as I mentioned before, he's someone who, I think he's an attorney in Seattle or something mm-hmm. now. He would certainly be someone to talk to about that.
In the middle of all this, reunions happened. Do you remember that aspect of it?
Boy, no, you know, I don't. I think those things, they take place, you know, over the course of a year several times, and so I don't have any, you know, any strong recollections of any one or another that happened. I do remember that Student Union Building was certainly a kind of gathering point for us in a lot of the activities we did, and so to the extent that there were alumni activities going on that went on there, you know, they were certainly aware of our presence. But boy, I hadn't given that a lot of thought. Did you have people who you've interviewed who were at reunion?
No, I wish I could find somebody who was. I haven't found that, but I would love to get.
I'm sure they would have viewed it with displeasure. let's take a minute break then.
Okay. So, shall we shift gears? Because maybe I bumped you dry on
maybe,
this.
Maybe. Maybe give me a chance to.
Okay. Let me. I got a totally out in left field question. Were you around for Mel Greenberg?
Oh, yes, I remember Mel Greenberg. That was a very funny time.
Tell about Mel Greenberg.
Ah, boy. Mel Greenberg was, I guess, some kind of a scam artist who came into town, and I don't remember exactly when it was now. You probably have got something that has got the date and time.
I can find out. But
he was supposedly making a movie. And he had set himself up at the Cadet General, as I recall. And he had rooms and was interviewing, you know, potential actors and extras for his movie. And he was supposedly some big Hollywood producer. And boy, I didn't go and you know, try and get interviewed or anything, but many people did, and he was treated very well. I mean, he was partied and wined and dined, and as I recall, either city or county officials, you know, were really trying to woo him to do this film in Rockbridge County and so on. Turned out he was just a total scam artist. That there was no. There was no film, he had no connection to Hollywood, or, you know, maybe he had stayed in Hollywood once or something. I don't know, maybe, you know, Larry or Sally Mann might have a lot more information about
it. I think I remember them talking about it. I don't know, it just flashed through my head that you were probably there at
that
time.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember, you know, he was kind of a, as I recall, sort of a flashy, middle-aged guy in a leisure suit, sort of acting like he was a big-time producer from Hollywood, and he really had people snowed over. I do remember that, and you know, it seemed too good to be true. Well, he was offering huge amounts of money for people to be actors and extras and so on. It just didn't completely make sense to me, and I didn't get, I guess, closely enough involved to give you a lot of particulars about what he offered individual people and so on, but there were stories about hanky-panky in the hotel rooms, and then I don't know whether he was caught or whether he left town without paying his bill there at the Cadet General. I wonder if there's anyone at the Cadet General who would, you know, remember the specifics, but he flew the coop. I think he was eventually caught doing another scam in Roanoke.
Should have gone farther away.
Yeah.
Well, you've mentioned the classroom a few times. I guess since we're talking about your university days, we ought to talk a little bit more about academics. Were there teachers who made a big difference in your life?
Well, there were several at Washington and Lee. I'd say probably Harry Pemberton was the one who made most difference. I majored in philosophy, and so that was my, he was my advisor, and I think probably Ramsey Martin, who has been head of the department, I think he retired this year. Probably wouldn't think as highly of me. I didn't do as much in terms of logic and that whole end of philosophy as he might have liked. But certainly Harry Pemberton really brought a lot of insight, and I took many courses from him, and he definitely had a way to bring you into the to the whole realm of thought of the ancients, if you will. I remember he did seminars on, you know, Plato, and there was a lot of sort of role playing in the way that Plato's books and works had people engaged in discussion, and that was I think he made a big difference to me in terms of how I looked at things, and certainly opened up my eyes to a lot of philosophers and so on. Although I didn't take any courses from him, Dr. Ju, who was in the art department, who later went on to start the art farm, and I believe he's still there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he still teaches at all. Mm-hmm. But he, was someone who I've met, who I admired a lot, and who he wasn't in any way involved in sort of the early days, the radical thought or anything like that. But just that the Chinese painting and the whole tranquility that he sort of had as an aura around him was was an influence, and I knew, you know, many students of his, and so I met him, and, you know, in that I would meet them there, and at that time the art department and the philosophy department were both in the same building, and so there was interaction there. I'm trying to remember some of the other professors who I liked. Certainly Jim Boatwright I liked a lot. And I don't remember how many courses, if any, I took from him, to be honest with you. Maybe one. I just have to think back on that in terms of professors. I mean, I remember a lot of things about the, for example, the phys ed department, which at the time I didn't think much of the physical education requirements, and I tended to take, you know, whatever the courses were that I thought would be easiest to just get through and not have to deal with very much, such as skiing. I think I took skiing twice. That was because we didn't have enough snow the first year. And In fact, I remember now they gave me an incomplete in skiing one semester because there wasn't enough snow for us to have all the skiing lessons. We actually drove to the homestead to do our skiing. And in later years, I took things like bowling. But even there, I had my arguments. For example, I'm sure that Coach Lord will not be happy to remember me. He had in a bowling class, he had an arrangement where you would place bets. He was trying to sort of get the interest going, not place bets really, but everybody would put down a certain amount of money and whoever won or had the best score that day would get the pot. And I remember objecting to the gambling during sports and even writing a letter to Dean John, and very, I think he was probably pretty upset at me for doing that. And as I recall, I actually had one credit to go, and they ended up changing my incomplete to a pass in the old skiing course, so they didn't
get
have
you
to
out
deal
there.
With me anymore. They probably don't remember me with any fondness, if at all. Put me out of their minds. I took a lot of journalism courses, actually, and now Pat Heinle would be the one to really tell you about the journalism department, but he certainly had a lot of people over there who were his mentors, I think, in the early years. But I took a number of film courses, and boy, why can't I remember the professor's name?
Tom Riegel.
Tom Riegel, of course. Anyway, and I thought very highly of him. He was a very interesting person, and I actually thought seriously about changing my major to journalism, and I probably wasn't that far away from being able to do it in terms of the number of courses that I took. But he was certainly an influence on me in that way. And I think just someone who had a lot of insights into what was going on in the real world, and he certainly had been involved in film and production other than in the academic area. So that was, you want to pause this for a second while we, I was hoping we could.
So one of the other things, were we in the middle of something? Did you want to continue?
No, I think we had kind of, we talked about Tom Riegel.
Oh, right,
where we stopped.
Yeah.
And,
so was fancy dress still going on?
Yes. I mean, it still went on. It was something that I never attended in my years over there. I mean, this was definitely the counterculture aspect of my time at Washington and Lee. It was not a...
Hold on.
But all those kind of events, I mean, they were certainly related a lot to what was happening with the fraternities. And usually it was, you know, one of the fraternities or president of one of the fraternities would be president of fancy dress. And it just was a whole different scene that I think there were parallel sort of routes that people could take still, you know, that much as we tried to get people interested or active as far as the anti-war scene and all of that, there was still a lot of just the traditional activities of the university and the fraternities and so on that continued basically unchanged. And I mean, I guess events on campus like that were just not really of much interest to myself or most of the people who I, you know, spent time with at that point.
But they were still going on.
I mean, there may have been a year when they stopped them, but I don't remember.
I know at some point, fancy dress, Fran Lawrence talked about it, at some point it just died out for 2 or 3 years.
For lack of interest or whatever.
I think it just kind of petered out for lack of interest. But I'm just not clear when that was.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it going on, and I remember that the groups, I mean, you know, the kind of music that we were listening to was the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane and, you know, the Allman Brothers and so on. And Fancy Dress was, you know, much more traditional in terms of music.
Were there any particular big concerts or important speakers who came during your time?
Oh, gee. There were definitely some important speakers, and I'm just trying to remember. I'd have to go back, though, and think. Probably Patrick would really be the one to talk to about that, Patrick Heinlein. Even concerts, I mean, there were concerts on campus, you know, pretty regularly, but even those, I didn't go to too many. It just was, the scene was just not, you know, was not the same scene that I was interested in, if you will. I guess in that way, I'm probably not as good a person to give you a broad picture of the era as someone who, you know, stayed in town and really saw the things that went on the campus, you know, 24 hours a day and so on. My freshman year was really the only year that I spent, you know, a lot of time on campus. Then maybe my senior year, which, since I skipped out for a year and came back to finish in 1974, that year I certainly spent a lot of time on campus. And, I mean, academically, that was time when I put my nose to the grindstone, pretty much. But,
did you literally leave town?
No, I stayed in Lexington.
And just didn't attend classes for
a
year?
What happened was, and I'd have to go back again to my transcript to see, but I had signed up for my senior year for courses that were, you know, courses that I wanted to take, and out of the, I guess, four courses that I was due to take that first semester of my senior year, when the application came back, or when the registration came back, I had been not admitted to any of them, not for academic reasons, but supposedly because they were full. And then when I went to the registrar, I found that there were juniors who had been admitted and that I had not been admitted as a senior, and it was my last chance to take those courses. And so, needless to say, I was pretty perturbed about the whole thing. And I, you know, I went to the dean and basically demanded that I be let into some of those courses, and they said, well, no, they're all closed now, it's all a done deal. And so I withdrew, and I mean, I don't know, you know, my father was pretty upset, probably more with me than with the university, but I was very perturbed at that time. And so I worked for a year, and probably put me into the occupation that I've ended up in now, in terms of pretty much the only thing you could do was construction or something along that line. And even then, around Lexington, there wasn't that much going on. And I had to travel to Covington and different places to work.
Well, you know, that was one of the things. When I moved to Lexington in 1977, I was fascinated at how well-educated the carpenters were in that town. So many of you from that era stayed, or stayed for a while. What was going on there?
Well, I think it probably was the lure of the country, you know, the rural setting. That certainly was very attractive. Probably, in retrospect, a lot of it was just trying to hold on to, you know, those aspects of the college years that were the most enjoyable, or the ones that I, you know, had gotten the most pleasure from, if you will. also for me, I don't know about the other people who stayed and, you know, did carpentry or did whatever they did, blacksmithing and so on. I think I didn't really have any roots in the States because I had lived overseas in different countries all my childhood, and so to the extent that I was going to go somewhere, at that point, since I went, from the time I got to college, my parents had moved from Switzerland to Ohio and then to Michigan, and I didn't really have any connection with, you know, where they lived, and certainly in terms of graduating from college and going back to live with my parents, that was just not even an option that I would have considered. And with my degree in philosophy, there wasn't exactly a big job market for me to jump into either, if I had wanted to. And so I just kept with what I had been doing, you know, in the year when I was off. And I guess to the extent that I was able to earn a living and maintain the lifestyle that I'd had, that was all I was really looking for. In retrospect, I think that was also one of the big failings of the university at that time, although I can't blame it totally on the university, but to the extent that so many of us kind of went on a different track, there really wasn't any, you know, counseling or I mean, there were some counselors, but there really wasn't a lot of emphasis on getting people pulled back into a career track, or, you know, I think people who were in, say, the commerce school, the C school as it was called, you know, they certainly had a track already in mind, and, you know, by the time they were in their senior year, they were interviewing with companies for jobs and so on. And I think we, the people who I knew, none of us were really along, you know, in that mode at all to begin with, but we pretty much sort of found our way in the dark, if you will, in terms of stumbling upon occupations. And I think you probably should talk to John Gunner if you haven't. He certainly would be one to talk to. And he's someone who I knew during my student years, but only very slightly. I think a lot of the people who had moved to country places, although there's talk of these parties and wild events and so on, which did happen with some regularity, I think there was also just sort of getting away from it all and going to the country and working and living a fairly quiet life in a non-urban setting. I think that was very appealing to me and probably to a lot of people. In terms of my focus on the long term, I think that's something that I didn't really have then. And it was not really something that was encouraged, I think, at least in any formal way. But I'm trying to think of things that happened in later years, say in my junior or senior year. There were certainly several people in the Chaos General Staff, if you want to call it, Ray Clements, who dropped out, Bill Green, who ended up living at Chaos West, dropped out. There were a number of people who I think suffered because of the drug scene and because of the fact that, as with anything, any kind of drug, or whether it be alcohol or whatever, there are some people who are going to be susceptible to just go off the deep end with it. And I'm not saying that's the case with all the people, but certainly I saw many people who, withdrew or left because they had gotten in too deep, in over their heads. And certainly in my freshman year, there were a number of people who experimented with psychedelics who just, lost it altogether. And that was a very sad thing, I think. I guess to another extent also the fact that people kind of went their own ways during those last few years was due in no small way was due to the fact that this drug scene that had developed really got pretty serious after a while. I mean, there were clearly people who were getting into the hard stuff, if you will, and that was very, very troubling to me. Certainly I saw people who were, getting into, what I considered the hard stuff, cocaine and other opiates and things like that, that really kind of separated people out. You either were or you weren't, and I wasn't, so people certainly kind of went over the edge that way. And I think that probably in those last couple of years that I was there, there were drug busts, and some students were sent to jail, that was a time when things had kind of come full circle. There was no longer sort of that carefree attitude that there was in the early days. It's amazing in some ways the different tracks that people did go on. I remember Ben West, who is now a very successful advertising executive down in Tampa, I guess, or St. Petersburg, Florida, who certainly partied with the best of them, if you will, and was probably the person who introduced me to this group of chaotic people, if you will, and who, of all of them that I know of, has sort of risen above all that into a sort of success in the financial business world, if you will. He would probably be a good person for you to talk to, actually. He was, featured in the alumni magazine a few issues back.
There's actually somebody else down there I need to talk to, so.
Was that right?
He's in Tampa area?
I think he's in Tampa now. He was from Jacksonville originally, and I know that he worked in New York for Young and Rubicam for a while, because I had an uncle who was the chairman of Young and Rubicam, and so we had helped make a connection back then. Anyway.
Well, just to sort of round things out, when I first arrived in Lexington, not only were there all these very well-educated carpenters, but a theme that I picked up on very quickly were there's seemed like every other car had a bumper sticker on it that said chaos.
Oh.
Do you ever see chaos bumper stickers anymore?
I haven't in quite a long time, actually. I think I still have one or two stowed away somewhere for posterity, but I guess what I would say about chaos was that it was it was more of a response to what was actually going on, that the world had been turned upside down somewhat at that point for so many of us in terms of what we had, what our expectations were and what the realities were. And so the bumper sticker chaos was more telling it like it was, as opposed to trying to create chaos, if you will. I mean, that was, it wasn't so much that we were saying things should be chaotic as that things are chaotic and you just have to deal with it. And of course I've looked with interest on all these chaos theories and so on that have come out in recent years, and you know, certainly there's some element of that in the universe, and but I think that's what really what that was about, and it was just a recognition, really, is all it was. Although I'm sure it was seen to some extent as a threat to the established order, if you will. And I remember, yeah, we got those bumper stickers printed up that first year. Oh, I think there were lots of things done with those bumper stickers that shouldn't have been.
Like?
Like they were put on street signs, as I recall, one night. I don't remember everyone who was involved in it, but, you know, so that Nelson Street became Chaos Street, and no parking anytime became no chaos anytime, things like that. I think that was just youthful pranks and probably more considered vandalism nowadays. But
how much do you think people like Bob Huntley were aware of chaos?
Probably more than we knew. You know, I felt like they had, and I'm trying to remember the person who was in charge of security, or
Murph,
yeah, right. I think he knew, he had several people working for him who kept tabs on this kind of stuff. I think he probably knew who was who and, you know, what was going on where. You know, I think to a certain extent his job had become sort of being an intermediary to prevent any kind of conflict, or not conflict, but problems to occur between the town police and the students, because certainly some of the activities that were going on were either illegal or questionable. But I suspect that, you know, a lot of the activities were not, if not monitored, that there was some knowledge of who, you know, who was who and what was happening with what people. And certainly in the times when there was a student strike and all that kind of activism, I think there was very much more heightened awareness of, you know, who were the leaders of the strike and who, you know, who were organizers. And I can't imagine that he didn't have sort of some kind of reports coming in. You know, I think the point there was that in general, the people who were on campus were not violent, were not interested in destruction of property, basically. So I guess with the exception of, I think Abby Hoffman came to campus once, there was probably some concern at that point, but I think if you could get Jeff Jingle to talk about those times, or Henry Sloss, I think would also be someone who, you know, had a lot of insight into the happenings in the in terms of the faculty and the administration and what awareness they had of what was going on.
Yeah, I need to track them down.
But anyway.
Well, thank you, Sean. We're just right at the end of the tape.
Okay. Well,
if there's anything else, I'd be glad to pop in another tape. But
Well, no, I mean, I think I pretty well drained myself.
Well, thank you. It's been great to get your reminiscences.
You're welcome.